There were, he explained, two aspects of evolution to be considered, the evolution of the human body, together with the growth and devolution of the earth itself, and the far more important aspect of the evolution of the soul of man. It will be a help, he observed, if we try and grasp the essential difference between God unmanifest and God manifest. It is sometimes asserted that God, being perfect, cannot know imperfection and therefore cannot know of man's sufferings. That is a purely intellectual argument, it is not true. God is perfect and eternal, that is to say he exists in timelessness and spacelessness, he is in no way limited. But divine intelligence permeates everywhere. No created thing could exist for an instant were it not held in being by the manifested will of the Creator. At any point in the whole universe you can touch him and be aware of his love and influence. In his pristine glory he is unmanifest, perfect, complete. But if there is to be experience, if his creation is to learn of his love, it must be subject to experience, it must be a little less than perfect. For you cannot paint a picture with only white paint, there must be color, contrast. So the pure white beam of perfection passes through the prism of manifestation into its myriad colors and shades. That is the nearest we can get to comprehension of the mystery of creation, for the finite mind cannot contain the infinite. Do not think of God as an individual, for that it is a limitation, but rather as an origin, the superlative of all you hold precious. You speak of man as an entity, but his spirit is universal, he shares it with all creation, where there can be no subdivision. Is that too hard for you to grasp? Remember that spirit is fluid, like the atmosphere. You cannot subdivide it, it is the raw material of creation. It is the life in an atom, in an animal or a stone, as in the human soul. Let us say that the intelligence of God caused atoms of his intelligence to individuate as souls, each growing in his love and gathering to itself more and more of what spirit is. Bound to him by the bonds of love, these souls developed and grew in consciousness, utterly giving themselves to their Father. If a man truly loves a maid, he longs to surrender his whole life to hers, making them one. It becomes an agony if they have to separate. So, as you grow in understanding, will it become an agony to separate yourself from the will and love of God? You will long to melt within the glory of his being in a divine consummation, still holding your identity but giving it eternally into his keeping. That is the real kingdom. At first the newly established soul is in a state of innocence, lacking experience, lacking the ability to generate love or to accept it. Just as a babe has to learn to love its mother through the mother's love for it. Through its experiences the soul grows in individuality, which is an eternal quality, not to be confused with the transient nature of personality. It would be folly to suggest that a human soul commences its life at human birth. It could never face the intolerable conditions of human existence which too often meet it. It would flee the body in horror at what it beheld, so antipathetic to what it knew of the reality of love. First must it acquire wisdom and be armored against the harshness of earthly life. So as it descends in experience it dons garments that shield it from gross contact, and has to drink of the waters of Lethe, before it can incarnate into the world of men, thus leaving behind the memory of the glories it once knew, which could only provide a drag on its progress. But never is it bereft of the love of the Father which sustains it, even though that love be denied. God could not desire a race of robots, dancing to his tune, so he gave his children the divine gift of free will, through which they might climb upwards to reality. But man can never possess absolute free will, there are limitations, there are thorny hedges of suffering to prevent him from straying too far. Suffering brings him to a halt, stuns the senses and allows his spiritual nature to assert itself and eventually gain control. One more factor I must stress for your understanding. There are two aspects of man, masculine and feminine, and each individual expresses a bias to one side or the other, irrespective of sex. A man may be feminine in outlook and vice versa. There is not that sort of bias in the soul, which is sexless but can assimilate masculine or feminine characteristics. The further the soul descends towards human incarnation, the more does it express itself the one way or other. Throughout its experience, the soul is animated by these twin influences, the magnetic pull of desire, the feminine characteristic, or the masculine lure of ambition, the creative attraction of power, which when misused can wreak such devastation. You can see how much you have to learn. Between these two poles of ambition and desire, man grows in experience and develops character, and what he learns is carried over into his soul life as individuality. All this time he is adding to his spiritual strength, which enables him to turn his selfish ambition into givingness, his desire for self into higher channels. For as he learns of his own reality, so the power of love enters into and illumines his being. That is much more important than the evolution of his brain. There should not be conflict between man and woman, for they are one at heart, two halves of a perfect whole, not equal but complementary. One gives what the other lacks. Separate they are meaningless, together they are creative. In its pristine state, the soul is androgynous, male and female in one, but in its descent into incarnation it comes to a point where it meets the mystery which you call original sin. It is a long, long story, impossible to deal with here, but there was a rebellion in heaven, desire beckoned to ambition, and together they trod a path among forces they were not ready to control. Thus they were thrust out of the Eden of perfect living in the sight of God, and they entered the mists from which mankind is still being rescued. Incarnation became a painful process, spiritual freedom gave place to the restrictions of human existence, memory of the perfect life had to be erased, and a veil drawn between the two. As I shall try to show you, the soul found it more and more difficult to incarnate as a whole entity, and inevitably came the bifurcation of the sexes, with man and woman as separate identities. This was naturally a terrible experience to the soul, which had hitherto known only perfection and wholeness, and you may feel that it is unfair for the souls of the present to suffer for the sins of ancient days. Yet remember that humanity is really one entity, it has no real life apart from that which emanates from God, in Him it finds reality. Apart from him its life is transitory and synthetic. No one soul can race ahead into heaven by itself, first it has to find that part of itself which has been living a separate existence, and oh the joy of that reunion. But heaven is not an Elysium for honeymoon couples, it is not enough to love one another nor even to love their father. Before they can appreciate the true depth of their mutual love, they have to learn of their unity with all other souls. For in the purity of spirit there is no space between one soul and another. They are all one in God. That may seem difficult of understanding, but try and remember this truth during your forthcoming experiences and it will assume shape and reality. Your two great Christian commandments, to love God and each other, are not ideals but dynamic necessities for your advancement. Only when you have mastered them, as you grow from time into eternity, will you be ready for your reunion in fullest measure with that which you have lost in the mists of endeavor. As Zero spoke, it seemed as if a great light was being shed upon my understanding. The scattered pieces of a jigsaw puzzle were being assembled to show a picture of a magnitude that amazed me, so wonderfully alive that I felt drawn into it. There must be no misunderstanding about what I have said, Zero went on. Soul unity has no relation to sex as you know it. To realize that you have a soul partner implies no disloyalty to the one with whom you may be linked in human experience, for love, in its highest expression, is like spirit, it has no direction, no possessiveness, no limitation, no jealousy, it is universal. Before you are ready for this divine reunion, there must be no living soul outside your love. Only then can you taste fully of the joy of your remarriage with that from which you have been separated through the ages. During its incubation period, the nascent earth was plastic in nature and inhabited by angelic beings who prepared it for its destiny. There was no water in its fiery constituency, but the elements of water were combined with other elements to form an ethereal plane far above what would now be its surface, somewhere in your stratosphere. This ethereal belt formed an environment for equally ethereal beings who incarnated there from the realms of spirit, lovely souls which were descending into experience. We may term this almost perfect race the Adamic race, offspring of spirit with matter. They possessed powers of which you do not dream today, for they were very close to the Creator of all. But as the cooling earth enabled organic life to exist, there came to its actual surface, first the animal kingdom and then a race of indigenous inhabitants in dense material bodies, little more intelligent than the animals amid whom they roamed. These were they who had expressed self-will in the realms of spirit, defying the love of God, and thus been cast out of his sight, which they could no longer endure. It was an act of mercy that they were enabled to seek relief from the terrible results of their disobedience by this alternative of physical incarnation. Thus there were two races incarnate, the shining ones in the Adenic realm above the earth who were descending in experience, and the darker souls who were seeking an upward path, back to the uplands of spirit where they belonged. And the shining ones took upon themselves the task of visiting the indigenous inhabitants of the misty lands below to minister to them and aid them in their rehabilitation. Much, much more Zeros told me, which I cannot stay to record here. But it was to this ethereal world in the stratosphere that I was next translated by the spiritual powers of Zeros, to witness the lives of a strange people of unbelievable beauty dwelling in a state of Adenic bliss, the first true men of Earth. It was indeed a setting of wondrous beauty. Imagine a scene of pastel shaded loveliness, the colors, the infinite shades, the brilliant flowers with a livingness of their own, with a clearness of atmosphere that enhanced a perspective of such grandeur that the mauve-tinted hills, however distant, seemed to be outlined with a detail that was unreal. I can scarcely find words to describe itself in appeal, this Garden of Eden, so much more real than any human fancy could depict. Everywhere was nature exemplified in its purest, most exotic beauty, undefiled by the hand of man and his perversions. Nowhere did I see signs of cultivation, though fruit trees of many unfamiliar kinds abounded. The colors and scents that pleasured the senses were beyond any that we know, and the animals we saw were obviously unafraid as they stepped their dainty way through the trees. The birds combined brilliant plumage with tuneful song in a way which we rarely witness. Then the people, how shall I describe them? Zeros was now perfectly visible to me, but neither of us had any contact with the inhabitants of this garden beautiful by way of communication. They had no knowledge of our presence. They were all seemingly of one sex, a curious admixture of feminine grace and manliness. Their clothes appeared to be shaped to their bodies in some clever way, as if they were part of them, and shone as if lit by some inner light. The colors were lovely but self-colors, there was no sign of embroidery, nor was there any need. All were fair of skin and walked with an effortless grace that was lovely to see. I saw no children and asked Zeros about this. Why should there be children? He queried. Why enclose a soul within an ineffectual body when there is no need? These Adamic people are born as adults with their brain faculties complete, needing only education and experience. I see over there some sort of ceremony about to take place, I think it will explain what I mean. Taking me by the hand, Zeros enabled the pair of us to travel over the intervening space and at speed. We drew near to where, in a grove of trees, an altar stood, and about which a crowd of people were gathered. Beside the circular altar stood a man of unusual height and appearance. He seemed to be a priest, for he was giving an invocation as we approached. Then he turned and faced the congregation, of whom each pressed forward to lay same small offering and the altar. Some gave fruit, same produced small objects they had picked up. It seemed that the nature of the object was immaterial. When all had contributed, the priest turned to the altar and, after a prayer, raised his arms, and immediately a ray of intense light shot downward, and in a moment the objects were reduced to nothing. Zeros explained that this was the origin of sacrifice, a demonstration and a reminder to the people that all came from God. It was a way of keeping in touch with Him. The consuming of the gifts in the flame of spirit signalized the rising of the spirit out of mortal matter, the flame of immaculate desire lighting the soul into the presence of God. We left the priest explaining the symbolism to his people. Once again we traveled across country as my companion expanded further upon the subject of birth in this pristine land, observing that we were now to witness such an event. This time we alighted at the entrance to a great building of symbolic beauty of design. I stood entranced, every facet of it seemed to have a message, though I could not interpret any known meaning. It stood at the foot of a great mountain, stretching so high into the sky that it seemed to have no summit. There was something mysterious about it, it seemed so aloof yet it was vibrant with importance. It did not surprise me when Zeros explained that this was the holy mountain of which mythology speaks so often. For same moments I stood gazing up at those somber heights, shrouded in mystery. But the mountain remained loftily aloof, it had no message for me. At his bidding I followed Zeros through the great doorway, with its delicately scrolled designs and motifs, there were no doors fitted. Up the steps and into the dim sanctity of a hall so vast that I could scarcely discern the carven roof, supported on pillars that spread out like great branches at the apex. The lighting puzzled me, for there were no windows, yet the hall was lit as if by sunshine. I never succeeded in discovering how it was done, Zeros could be quite inscrutable when he chose. At the far end of the hall were grouped same 200 people, almost lost in this vastness. Something was obviously about to happen, for all were gazing expectantly towards a doorway at the end of the hall which was covered by a rich velvet curtain. Presently there was a stir and as the curtains swung noiselessly aside a procession entered the hall, to take up position by a small slab of greenish stone. First came the principal actor in this drama of pre-human birth, the parent-to-be, arrayed in spotless white and wearing a rapt trance-like expression that spoke of the strenuous nature of his preparation and his dedication to its fulfillment. At this point Zeros murmured, "You should emphasize in your narrative that these people were androgynous in nature. They still retained their masculine and feminine characteristics in one form. They were created male and female, dual in nature. Here was no marriage or mating. With all its difficulties and disillusion, these beings could love each other without restraint, without any intervention of sex." The subdued chatter ceased, hushed by a sensitive awareness of what was to come. Then in front of the curtain a golden haze began to appear, to resolve itself into human shape. Gradually a shining being took human form, so radiant as to be almost blinding to the eyes. He radiated an inner power that streamed from him and affected us all, I could feel its benign influence from where I stood. Zeros explained that this being had come from a higher realm to take part in the ritual, which was designed to keep ever before the minds of the people their unity with spiritual realities they might otherwise forget. Now the whole tempo of the proceedings was speeded up. As I watched I noted the curious haze beginning to gather about the visitor's head. Evidence of the tremendous power he was drawing upon. No doubt this light accounted for the halos depicted above the heads of saints in medieval pictures. By way of welcoming the celestial visitor the people began to chant in unison. It was not a song in words but rather of ritualistic intonation, subtle inflections that rose and fell like the murmur of the ocean. There was unutterable longing in their voices and some flung out their arms in a gesture of supplication. The song died, and the watchers stood perfectly still, quiet and alert. The teacher began to speak. With such a voice that any actor would long to possess. Perfectly modulated, it had a quality of perfection that enhanced the words he said and gave them added import. Though I could not understand the words I could well guess at their meaning. He spoke lovingly and understandingly to the people, as if they were very dear to him. It seemed that this race of lovely people was incarnating on a mission of great importance which even they could not as yet comprehend, for they were being prepared to descend into an even deeper phase of existence where they were to help the indigenous inhabitants to rise out of the pit into which they had fallen. The two races were to meet and fuse on the surface of the cooling earth below them, thence to rise together into the light once more. A magnificent epic of redemption which a benign creator had planned before ever the earth was born. After a pause the teacher spoke of the importance of the ritual about to be observed. Then one who was to stand sponsor stepped forward and made a salutation, while the parent-to-be was by now almost in a state of trance. I will not attempt to describe the ceremony, for its ritual meaning was lost upon me. But presently the rapt parent became enveloped in a golden haze which gradually deepened and slowly gathered into form about his solar plexus. At length it could be seen that this was assuming a human form which finally separated itself from the parent. The celestial visitor now took charge and guided the form to a recumbent position on the low altar. The singing had now recommenced and it appeared to take the form of a species of midwifery, with the onlookers contributing power through which this divine birth might be concluded. At last, with a final paean of sound, the birth was completed. There, on the altar, lay a perfect specimen of manhood, newly born and adult in size, but needing much care and attention before he could take up his new life. Gently the sponsor bent and lifted the supine body, offering it to the celestial one, who blessed it. Then the figure was covered with a cloak and carried from the hall. As we left the hall, I asked Zeros why this method of birth was denied to modern man. He shook his head gravely. That is another matter, which I will try and make clear to you on another occasion. So saying, he took hold of my hand and once again propelled the two of us swiftly across country. We landed this time at the entrance to a building quite different from the first. It was more utilitarian and the decorations were much simpler than those we had already seen. Here again we found many people being instructed by a celestial visitor. He was instructing them in the meanings of ritual dancing, with two neophytes to demonstrate the movements. At the conclusion of the talk, the whole gathering moved out into the open, a sort of amphitheater set against a background of trees. There was something familiar about the happy gathering with their animated movements and subdued laughter, much as we would expect from a dancing class in our own age. But at the appearance of the teacher, all noise ceased. He raised his hand and as at a signal, a thrumming of drums began, seeming to come from within a belt of trees. Louder and louder it got until its rhythm communicated itself to the dancers, and immediately they swung into step and formed themselves into rings and other forms. How graceful they were! There was none of the jerky posturing that so often characterizes our own dancers. Their whole bodies seemed to respond to the rhythm, and the delight on their faces showed the extent of the pleasure it gave them. There were many movements to the dance, and I felt sure that each had some symbolic meaning. There were moments when the unison was broken into pathos, moments when the swaying bodies swept apart and met again in a passionate demonstration of reunion. No longer was this a concourse of individuals but a moving panorama of contemporary life, a great unity of agreement in expressing the symbol of divine unity. It was impossible to watch this dramatic scene and not be moved by its message, never equaled in any ballet we have known. As these lovely creatures danced and weaved and swayed to their emotions, the light about their heads grew in intensity until it wove a concurrent pattern above them, crystallizing the symbology of the dance into visible form. That woven fabric of light postulated no mere chimera of the imagination but was clearly the weaving of dynamic magnetic forces into meaningful expression. In that divine ecstasy I felt drawn into at one moment with the dancers till I was part of them and they of me. My whole consciousness momentarily expanded until I felt that I belonged to all creation, and all creation had part with me. It took that dance to bring this transcendent truth home to me. Finally, the dancers resolved themselves into a set piece and came to a palpitating rest upon a cessation of the thrumming. And the design of the set piece was the ancient pattern of the cross within the circle, the symbol of sacrifice redeemed, which is the hallmark of our earth. But here it did not seem to breathe of sadness, suffering and revolt, but rather of a garland of flowers epitomizing immense love and forgiveness, scintillating because of the quivering of the bodies, until at last they were stilled, and the light coalesced into ethereal form, somewhat like the domes and minarets of some vast temple of exquisite design. It seemed that beauty itself was crowning the dancers with applause. Everywhere I went in this strange and beautiful land, there was this educative inspiration, presenting mystical realities in simple, symbolic terms. Thus was taught the first lesson between light and shade, so soon alas to deepen into good and evil, eternally at war. Here indeed was a testing of spirit, the building of an inner conviction of realities that would steer this people through the testing times ahead when they would be called upon to take part in the struggle of human minds against the great mind of the universe. Maybe the hints of a chosen people that grace the pages of the Bible had their genesis in what I had just seen. Many were the talks I had then and later with Zeros upon this difficult subject, the origin of sin. How I wish I had the skill to interpret all he told me. You must not think, he said, that the Creator could possibly have designed a creation that could fail, nor that he purposely planned the gradual evolution of intelligent form through endless ages of suffering and strife. That is a byproduct of the gift of free will without which your progress would be that of robots. Divine prescience must have foreseen the fall of spiritual man and his continued fall through defiance of goodness. And the history of man is that of divine forgiveness and regeneration, forever forestalling man's divergence and bringing him back, through suffering, to the way of divine destiny. Mankind rises on the wings of pain because that is the only way man will rise. The soul of man changes as he advances and gains an accretion of what spirit is, that which could never be changed or destroyed. Death has no meaning in the ultimate idea of creation, it is an aspect of the fallen nature of man and the world in which he lives. To this Adamic race death never comes unheralded, they do not see it as an enemy waiting to catch them by the heels, as you do. When the allotted span draws to a close, the fortunate one knows he has accomplished what he set out to do, and is the subject of congratulation. There is no regret, no sadness. Just the gentle laying down of the garment no longer needed, and then the departure into a joyous freedom. The body merely disintegrates. Not once but many times did Zeros and I return to this wondrous realm, and widely we roamed. I have not space to tell of all we saw, and it is difficult to put into words events that have no corollary in human experience. It is difficult too for us, who have to labor so hard merely to exist, to comprehend an environment in which labor has no imposition to make. But, as Zeros explained, man has become a fighting machine with militant instincts to enable him to fight his way out of the impasse into which he has fallen. As he rises in consciousness, he will lose those predatory instincts and be amenable to gentler issues. It was an incredible thought that this whole environment was to descend, in total, onto the hard surface of Mother Earth, there to play its destined part in redeeming and unifying the whole. Incredible too that all this creative assembly, as in the wide universe, was held in being only by the Creator's will, without which it would rush into instant dissolution, back into primal energy. Here in the fineness of life there were no sexual differentiations, yet these souls too were to be subject to bifurcation ere they could be allowed to descend into the dense, harsh conditions of Earth proper, a sacrifice that was essential in order to provide the urge that would ensure their ultimate return to their pristine condition. How sad a thought that was, that the love of man for woman had to be expressed as such an incoherent and untamable form of emotion, belonging more to the animal than the spirit. How much do we not owe to these great souls who came to the rescue of fallen man, only alas, to fall victim to the viciousness inherent in the indigenous race of the primitive world. Even as I looked at the lovely scenes for the last time, I could not imagine its inhabitants becoming besmirched with the inky stains of evil, yet even then perhaps a tiny cloud of misunderstanding may have been passing across their thoughts, herald of a turning inward to their personal being, away from their outward receptiveness of spiritual influences. A shadow that would presently touch a thousand hearts with its cold fingers and draw a veil of forgetfulness over minds which as yet remembered only love. Chapter 7. The Crust Hardens. So far my visitor from other realms had shown me how intelligent life had descended into a near-physical existence on the earth. Now he was promising me that I should see something of this primeval life. The Earth has never been without intelligent life in charge of its progress. Always there was the throng of angelic and elemental beings weaving divine purpose into its cooling fabric, while ever and anon members of the Adamic race would flash downward to make some imprint of their own lovely world upon its surface.